So, y'all ready to get started? It's on monopoly. This is the second lecture. And I'm starting here at slide 22. And slide 22 says, when does the government grant a franchise? Now, what we're talking about here are something called natural monopolies. Now, what is a natural monopoly? Normally, we don't want monopolies because a monopoly can take advantage of their monopolistic position, right? If you've got a business that they're the only ones that are selling something, then they can take advantage of that, of their market power, and they can charge us a higher price, and we don't have any alternative but to pay that higher price. But what we're saying here is that sometimes there are situations where we actually want to be provided by a monopoly. So what would be some examples of this? When would we want to be provided by a monopoly? Like the example I gave last time was energy, power, electrical power, or maybe cable TV service. Why are these natural monopolies? Because we found that for several reasons, it's better to have one firm providing for us than several firms. Now, we're not talking about a monopoly for the whole United States, right? We're saying that in a certain locality, in a certain area, that the government is going to give a license to one firm, say, you have the right to sell this product or service in this area and no one can compete with you. And the reason that we do that is because, well, take the a power company, for example. If one power company can provide us with sufficient power, why should we have five or six power companies with five or six sets of wires? That would be bad for the environment. It would be a waste of our natural resources. And so if one company can provide us with what we need, we say, well, we'll just have one company do this and have one set of wires. The other reason is that in many cases, it takes a lot of what are called sunk costs. A company has to, and the power company would have to spend a lot of money building a big generator, some power source, poles, wires, hiring labor, of course. All of this before they can provide 1 kilowatt worth of energy. And with such a big startup expense, then investors, because these type of investments are done by private investors, investors might say, well, there's a lot of risk involved here. We're spending a whole lot of money, and it's going to take maybe a long time, a year or two, before we can start making any money. And when you go out that far, that long, and you sink this much money into it, we've got to have a pretty good idea of what our return is going to be. And that return, of course, is based on our how many customers we have. If we allow competition, then it would be very difficult for a company to say how many customers they're going to have, because that would depend on how much competition they have. But if we tell that company that, look, you private investors, you can make this investment and you can be assured of X number of customers because we're going to guarantee that you're the only one that can provide power in this area. So this lowers the risk factor for investors. And that will encourage more investment. Whatever the government gives in one hand, however, it takes away with the other, correct? So the government might give monopoly status to a company, but what does it take away on the other end? Prices. We take away the ability for that monopoly to charge whatever price that it wants. We have a commission here, and the authority, this commission has the authority to give permission or not for a certain price structure. Now, let's say that you were a part of this commission. And it's your responsibility to say yay or nay to a certain price structure. What guide are you going to use to say this price is justified, but this higher price is not justified? I mean, what price is justified? What kind of profit do you want that natural monopoly to make? Well, wouldn't you want that natural monopoly to make a normal profit? See, what's a normal profit? A normal profit is the minimum amount of money that a business owner will continue operating the business. Below a normal profit, the business owner will say, this isn't worth my while. See, my opportunity costs are too high, and I'm going to go do something else. That's what a normal profit is. Now, that's exactly what we, if you were sitting on this commission, you would want to approve a price structure that would allow these business owners to make a normal profit. Because we have to give them enough incentive for them to do their thing. But we don't want to give them more than that because, after all, we've made sure that they're a monopoly. So we don't want them to take unfair advantage of their monopoly status. So if they can make enough money that they say to themselves, hey, this is worth our while, and we'll continue providing this service, or we'll make these investments, then that's great. Now, another interesting thing about this is that if power was supplied to us through a perfectly competitive market, what kind of profit would the firms that's part of that perfect competitive market make over the long run? What is the long run equilibrium in a perfectly competitive situation? It's normal profit, right? The long run equilibrium, over the long run, in perfect competition, the average firm will make a normal profit. I mean, how come? Because if economic profits are being made, what would happen? More firms would enter in to partake in those economic profits, supply would shift to the right, and price would come down, eventually eliminating the economic profits. The economic profit is any money made above and beyond the normal profit. And as that supply curve continued to shift to the right, eventually loss would be being made, or at least the average firm would now be making less than a normal profit. So what would some of those firms do? They would leave the industry. The supply curve would shift to the left. Price would go up, eventually restoring the normal profit, but going right on through there, because in life things don't just come to an abrupt stop. So that supply curve would continue shifting to the left. The market price would continue to rise, and now economic profits would be being made, and now more firms would enter in because in perfect competition we've got the easy entry, easy exit feature. But here in monopoly we don't have that easy entry, easy exit because we have very high barriers to entry. In the case of a natural monopoly, what's the barrier to entry? Well, it's government mandate. You know, we've passed a law saying, hey, no one can come in here to compete with you. That's a very high barrier to entry. So because of that high barrier to entry, see, a monopoly, I mean, not a natural monopoly, but just a monopoly, can make an economic profit year after year because no one can come in to cause the supply curve to shift to the right to lower price because of the high barriers to entry. But with a natural monopoly, what we're saying is, well, now, we want you to have this monopoly status, but we want your price structure to be the same as if this product was being provided to us in a perfectly competitive market. All right, I'm sure I got ahead of myself on these slides. When does the government grant a franchise? To slide 22, when it thinks the market in question is a natural monopoly. What are some examples of government franchises? A franchise would be when a company gets a franchise and that allows them to be a monopoly. U.S. Postal Service, telephone service, local electric, gas, water, utilities, cable TV. Now, this, some of these, I know I talked about this last time too. How much of a monopoly is the U.S. Postal Service? Well, it's much less today than it was maybe even five years ago. Because where does competition come from? I mean, like, take the Postal Service, for example. Is the competition for Postal Service other companies that deliver mail? How about online bill paying, for example? See, you people using credit cards and I mean, there's, you know, competition as society changes, technology changes, competition can come in forms that maybe 10 years ago wouldn't even be dreamed of. This is a problem that telephone companies are having, right? I mean, at one time they had a corner on the market because you know they would provide telephone service. I'm talking about landlines. But what's happened? Well, with cell phones coming into this, and on Skype, you can call anyone anywhere in the world and talk forever for nothing, and even see the person. And I mean, that's a heck of a competition. I mean, telephone companies can't do that, and so telephone lost market share, and so what you, things that used to be monopolies. Even natural monopolies are not as much of monopolies as they used to be. If a government franchise win-win deal for a protected company, no. Most often, government regulates its prices and profits. Okay, what is the government objective? For the monopoly to make a normal profit. Slide 25. Slide 26. Why is marginal revenue less than price for all but the first unit of output for a single price monopoly? And in all of this, we are assuming that once a monopoly determines what price to charge, it's going to charge the same price for all units. That's called a single price monopoly. We're not going to spend talking about a discriminating monopolist. See, now in perfect competition, what did we have? Remember in perfect competition, we had that horizontal line at the market price. And that horizontal line, four things were equal. We had the price, the market price, the firm short-run demand curve, marginal revenue, and average revenue. All those four were equal in perfect competition. Now, in monopoly, it's not like that. Now, monopoly, price equals average revenue. Now, why does price equal average revenue for a monopoly? At least a single price monopoly, and that's what we're talking about. Why does price equal average revenue? Because once a monopoly determines what price to charge, and it charges the same price to all customers, then if we take our total revenue and divide by quantity, what do we always get back to? See, total revenue divided by quantity is average revenue, correct? So when we do that, what do we get back to? Well, we always get back to our price. Why do we always get back to our price? Because we charge the same price for all units. See, now, for a monopoly, we are a price maker rather than a price taker. See, in perfect competition, we were price takers. We simply had to take whatever the market price is. But in a monopoly, well, we have to determine what is the best price to charge. But once we do that, we're going to charge the same price to all customers. And therefore, price equals average revenue. But price does not equal marginal revenue, except for the first unit of output. And how come that is? How come here in slide 26, why is marginal revenue less than price for all but the first unit of output? Because in order to sell more, what does a monopolist have to do? Lower price. And that price cut has to apply to all units, not just the last unit. All right, MR is less than price for all but the first unit of output. And this is a table here in slide 27. You've got quantity starting with 10 through 14 on the first column, and then price, total revenue in the third column, marginal revenue, in the fourth column. And now notice here that as we lower price, see it's $5.25 at 10 units, $5 at 11 units, $4.75 at 12 units. As we lower price, what happens to the number of units we can sell? It goes up. How do we get total revenue in the third column? Price times quantity equals total revenue, right? 10 times $5.25 is $50.50. 11 times $5 is $55, right? Price times quantity equals total revenue. Now, how do we get here, as we went from 10 units to 11 units, our margin revenue is $2.50. Well, it's simply the change in total revenue. Yeah, period. See, what was total revenue at 10 units? $52.50. What's total revenue at 11 units? $55. So how much do we add to our total revenue by making one more unit? $2.50, right? $55 minus $52.50. Now, how much revenue did we add to our total revenue as we lowered the price to $4.75? 57 minus 55, you know, 57 is our total revenue at 12 units, 55 is our total revenue at 11 units, 57 minus 55 equals 2. So our margin revenue as we went from 11 units to 12 units is $2. I'm saying that margin revenue is $2 as we went from 11 units to 12 units, because really it's a process. Margin revenue is how much we're adding to our total revenue in the process of producing one more unit, or selling one more unit. In this case, we're selling one more unit. Now, notice here, every time we lower price, are we charging different prices now for these different units? Are we charging $52.50 at the 10th unit and $55 at the 11th unit and $57 at 12 units? No. What are we doing? Once we determine price, then we're going to charge the same price for all units. And so margin revenue is less than price for all but the first unit of output. Okay, what is total revenue at the third unit? I'll give you some more practice here. What is an example of what you get on the test. This is slide 28. We've got price on the first column, $50, $40, $30. Quantity in the second column, quantity of 2 at $50, quantity of 3 at $40, quantity of 4 at $30. So what is total revenue at the third unit? 120 dollars. Why? Because 3 times 40 equals 120. That'd be a pretty simple one, right? I mean, if you get a question like this on a test, no one should get this wrong. Okay, what is margin revenue at the third unit?
20.
How'd you get 20?
You have to find the total revenue for the previous.
And total revenue. Yeah, exactly. See, it's $20. Because our total revenue at 2 units is 100, right? 2 times 50 is 100. Our total revenue at 3 units is 120, right? Because 3 times 40 is 120. And 120 minus 100 is 20. So our margin revenue at the third unit is $20. Okay, what is margin revenue at the fifth unit? Well, let's see. At the fifth unit, at 4 units, 4 times 30 is 120. And at 5 units, 5 times 20 is 100. So what have we got now? It's actually minus $20. Okay, in other words, we lost $20 as we lowered our price from 4 units to 5 units. We lost $20 on that last unit. Okay, so now here is a table, very typical of what you get on the test. And you've got a lot of columns here. You've got quantity on the far left, price, total revenue, margin revenue, total cost, marginal cost, and then your profit or loss in the last column. See, that plus and minus means profit or loss. So, given this information, how do you know that you would produce 10 units to maximize your profit? Now, I want to know what price to charge and what quantity to produce to maximize my profits or minimize my losses. Now, what is the answer to that question all the time? MR equals MC. But now, MR never equals MC here. So, what's the same thing as MR equals MC? The answer is the last unit, where MR is greater than MC. See, you go down. See, if you're given a table like this, and then you're asked this question, which you will be. I mean, this is the whole point here. I mean, this whole area is called price output determination, right? I mean, we're pretending that we have a monopoly, and we want to know what price to charge and what quantity to produce to maximize the profit or minimize our losses. So we ask the question, well, how many units are we going to produce and what price are we going to charge? And the answer to that, to those questions, is always MR equals MC, or the last unit where MR is greater than MC. Now, if we were looking at this thing on a graph, see, we talk about MR equals MC because on a graph, you got a marginal revenue curve and you got a marginal cost curve, and they're going to intersect somewhere, right? So we just like at the point of intersection, and we come down to our quantity axis, and well, that's what quantity we're going to produce where MR equals MC. But on a table, see, the advantage of a table is that it's more detailed than your graph. So on a table, MR may never equal MC. So we look now at the last unit where MR is greater than MC. See, because if we produce where MR equals MC, how much money are we making on the last unit? Let's say we're looking at a graph. We've got a marginal revenue curve, marginal cost curve. MR equals MC where they intersect. How much money are we making on the last unit? No, zero. We're not making any money. MR equals MC. Revenues equals costs. Our marginal revenue equals our marginal cost. We're not making any money in the last unit. How much money are we losing? We're not losing any money. Our marginal revenue equals our marginal cost. At that whole unit, you see, where MR equals MC. That's why it makes no difference if we produce where MR equals MC or we produce at the last unit where MR is greater than MC. See, it makes no difference because where MR equaled MC, we weren't making any money, then we weren't losing any money. The difference is zero. So in this case, MR doesn't equal MC, but see, I ask you, see, here's a big table. Now, it can be confusing. I mean, here we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 columns, and we've got 5 rows, and we've got all these numbers thrown up here. I mean, it looks like just one big mass of numbers. And, I mean, if you look at this table, I mean, it could be you're asked questions, and it could be very confusing. But it's not confusing if you know exactly what to look for. And in this case, it's very simple because the questions and answers never change. You always get the same question. What price are we going to charge? And how many units are we going to produce to maximize our profit or minimize losses? That's the first question. The answer to that question is always at the last unit, where MR is greater than MC. So what do? Well, we don't look at all these numbers all at once. All we concentrate on is the marginal revenue column and the marginal cost column. And then we look down those two columns and say, okay, now, where is the last unit where MR is greater than MC? And if you come down here, you say, well, at 10 units, that's the last unit where MR is greater than MC. See, at 10 units, MR is 3, and MC is $2.75. But now on the 11th unit, MR is $2.50, but MC is $3.25. So if we produce the 11th unit, how much money would we be losing on the 11th unit? 75 cents. Now, if we produce the 11th unit, would we be making a profit? How much profit are we making at 11 units? $11.75. See, we're still making a profit, right? But we are not maximizing our profit at 11 units. We're only maximizing our profit at 10 units. At 10 units, our profit is $12.50. See, how do we get our profit or loss in the last column? How do we know that it's at 10 units, our profit is $12.50? Because the third column gives us total revenue, and the fifth column gives us total cost. So total revenue minus total cost is total profit or total loss, right? See, this stuff is really easy once you take it, once you break it down. You got to break it down and look at it piecemeal. Now, sometimes total revenue column won't even be given to us, but we don't need it because how do we get those numbers under total revenue? Price times quantity. See, column 1 times column 2 will equal column 3. And then we really don't need our marginal revenue column either, right? Because our marginal revenue column we can derive ourselves if we know what total revenue is at each unit of output, right? Because it's always the difference between the present unit and the previous unit. And then same with marginal cost. If we weren't given the marginal cost column, well, we could figure that out too, because marginal cost is the difference between total cost of the present unit and total cost of the previous unit. And see, on a test, that may be the case too. You may be given parts of a table and then ask questions on the rest of the table. See, you don't have to be given a whole lot of information to be able to fill out all the rest. Now we have a picture on a graph here of the same thing. And what we've got here is a downward sloping demand curve with a capital D. Now notice, in perfect competition, when we looked at the demand curve, we were looking at small d, right? But now it's a capital D. How come? Because the monopoly is the industry, right? See, we've only got one seller. We're talking about a monopoly here. So the market demand curve is the same thing as the individual's demand curve. They're one and the same. We've got here a U-shaped marginal cost curve and a U-shaped average total cost curve. Now, how come these curves are U-shaped? The law of diminishing returns explains why these curves are U-shaped. All right. And on this, we have a marginal revenue curve. Now, notice that the marginal revenue curve is underneath our demand curve and more steeply sloped. And why is that? Because in monopoly, MR is less than MC, MR is less than P price for all but the first unit of output. And as quantity increases, see what happens when we want to sell more units? Well, the amount of money that we're losing on previous units is greater and greater and greater, right? Because maybe on the first unit, we could have sold one unit for $100, but we decided to sell 10 units at $10 a piece. So how much money did we lose on the first unit? $90. See, there was someone out there that might have said, oh, yeah, I'll buy that for $100. We could have sold one unit for $100. But we decided to sell 10 units. But in order to sell 10 units, we had to lower our price to $10. Now what's happening here is you got one person, one customer, that paid $10, but they were willing to pay $100. So you lost $90 on that customer. Now, the way the thinking goes, that maybe the second customer would have paid $90. But they only paid $10. So how much did we lose on the second customer? $80. See, and now the third customer, maybe they would have been willing to spend $70. But they only pay $10. So we lost $60. See what I mean? I mean, every time we want to sell a unit, and we have to lower price, but because that price cut applies to all units, not just the last, then it's cumulative. The amount of money that we are foregoing on previous customers becomes greater and greater and greater, and that's why the distance between the marginal revenue curve and the demand curve becomes greater and greater as Q increases. See that's how this is drawn. Now, I said marginal revenue is less than price for all but the first unit of output. What does marginal revenue have to do with the demand curve? Because what determines price? Demand. See, and demand equals average revenue because average revenue equals price. Demand determines price, and price always equals average revenue. At least for a single price monopolist, or any company that's selling all units for the same price. I mean, once the price is determined and we charge the same price for all units, then average revenue is going to equal price. You're presented with this graph. And what's the first question? The whole purpose here is to determine quantity and price. So the first question is, how many units are we going to produce to either maximize profit or minimize losses? And what's the answer? MR equals MC. So we've got a marginal revenue curve here, right? That reddish, orangish curve that's underneath our demand curve, or more steeply sloped. We've got a marginal cost curve, you know, that orange curve that's U-shaped, and they're equal at some point, right? So what do? Well, we go where MR equals MC, and we draw a line all the way up and all the way down. Now, remember that shortcut I talked about before? I mean, see, the MR equals MC rule simply gives us the first answer, how many units. Now, after that, it's of no importance. See, the only purpose of MR equals MC is to find the vertical line. Now, we forget about MR and MC, and all we do is concentrate on that vertical line. Now, what price are we going to charge to maximize our profit or minimize our losses? What always, even for a monopoly, what always determines price? Demand. So, see, what we do is we go all the way up to the demand curve, and then we cut across, and whatever price we come out at, that's the price that we're going to charge to maximize our profit or minimize our losses. Now, what I don't want some of you doing, which is a temptation, is you go where MR equals MC, and then to find price, you go across the price axis, you see. See, remember, once you find where MR equals MC, forget about it. Draw that vertical line and know that it's the demand that determines price, not MR equals MC. So you go up to your demand curve, and then you cut across to your price axis, and you get at $5.25. Now, how do we know that this is a case of profit maximization rather than loss minimization? Because at 10 units, now remember, no, see, you know, we forget about MR equals MC because we've already found that vertical line. Exactly, that's the answer. At 10 units, average revenue is greater than average cost. Right? See, where is average revenue at 10 units? Well, it's on our demand curve, right? Average revenue equals price. Price is $5.25, so average revenue is $5.25. And where is average cost? Well, average cost is where that vertical line, that dotted vertical line, intersects your average total cost curve. So it intersects your average total cost curve at $4. So what is our average profit? $1.25. And what is our total profit? Well, 10 times $1.25, right? See, this rectangle here the width of this rectangle is average profit, and the length of this rectangle is number of units. And if we take the multiply the width times the length of a rectangle, what do we get? The area of that rectangle. So this green area here, this rectangle, represents total profit. Now, if you're given a graph like this on a test, you think you could see, there's all kinds of questions I can ask here. And a big part of this unit is to be able to read a graph or read a table and answer questions. You know, gleaning information from a graph or a table. Now, this simply shows us the same thing, but in a different way. It's simply showing us that our profits are maximized where the distance between total revenue and total cost is the greatest. And we know that that's going to be at 10 units because that's where MR equals MC. See, maximum profit. But this graph here, I'm on slide 33, and it's showing us a total revenue curve and a total cost curve is not used nearly as much as the previous graph. Okay. Now, here's another scenario. How many units are we going to produce to maximize our profits or minimize our losses? Answer, MR equals MC. So, there's our vertical line, right? All the way, that dotted vertical line all the way up and all the way down here. We're on slide 34. Okay. So Q is our answer, right? We're going to produce Q units because that's where MR equals MC. All right, what price are we going to charge? And how do we determine price? Demand. So where's that dotted line intersect our demand curve? Yeah, at P, right? Now, how do we know that this is a case of loss minimization rather than profit maximization? At Q units. Exactly. At Q units, on that vertical line, our average costs are greater than our average revenues. In fact, what is that vertical distance on the dotted line there between our average total cost curve and our average revenue curve? Average loss. And we're going to produce Q units. So the width of this rectangle is average loss. The length is Q, and we multiply the width times the length, and we get the area of this rectangle. And the area of this rectangle represents total loss. Okay, now, what's the next question? Come on now, what's the next question? All right, you've got a business here, and you find that there's nothing you can do to make a profit. At all units, all prices, nothing you can do to make a profit. The best you can do is charge price P and produce quantity Q, whereby you will lose less money than any other combination. Okay, now, what is your concern? We already found that. It's P. Yes. Now the question is, we're making a loss. Should we stay open or should we close down? Now, what's the answer to that question? What do we consider to decide? Say, remember, what's microeconomics all about? Microeconomics is all about the decision-making process of economics, right? It's all about how to make correct decisions. So here we are. We've got information. We want to make the right decision. In this case, we got to decide: do we stay open or do we close down? Which is the best decision?
If your losses are less than your average
No. What is it we're looking at here? Your loss. What are we? What two things are we comparing? What kind of analysis is this? Short run or long run? This is a short run analysis. And in the short run, what do we have? Fixed costs. So what we've got to say is, okay, which way are we going to lose the most money? Are we going to lose more money if we stay open and continue to operate? Or should we shut down? Because we have these fixed costs. We've got costs that, even if we shut down, we still got to pay. You know, we still got to pay our property taxes, and we still got to pay certain salaries to certain executives, and a certain amount of our lighting bill, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, we've got fixed costs here. Because remember, in a short run, we cannot change our plant capacity, right? We can't just go out of business, because then that would take us in the long run. But this is a short run analysis. So in the short run, we have fixed costs. Now, in this case, stay open or close down. Now, you should be able to look at this and at an instant say, this is a shutdown case, or this is a stay open case. By just one quick glance. So what do you look for here? Well, how do you know it stay open? No, not total cost. What are we two things that we comparing? Now, remember I said MARC was MC, draw a vertical line. Now, where are all the answers? Come on now, where are all the answers? On the vertical line, on that dotted vertical line. So concentrate on that dotted vertical line. Should we stay open or close down? See, what is that vertical distance between your average revenue curve and your average cost curve? Average loss. What is the vertical distance between our average variable cost curve and our average total cost curve? Not fixed, but average fixed. Because average variable plus average fixed equals average total. So that vertical distance, any vertical distance between our average variable cost curve and our average total cost curve equals average fixed cost. So at a glance, the two things you look at is your average loss and your average fixed cost. Now, which is greater? Average fixed. What does that tell us? Well, what that tells us is that if we close down, we'll lose more money than if we stay open. See, it's better to lose this average loss amount then shut down and lose this average fixed cost amount. I mean, in terms of averages. See, we're comparing two averages here. You always want to compare like units. You know, average, totals with totals. You know, keep things simple. So here we're talking about averages because that's what's on the vertical line. Okay, any questions about this? Slide 34 before we go on. This is really basic. I mean, so a lot of what we've done here has simply been leading up to this graph. Okay, when will a monopolist shut down if no price covers average variable costs? Can a monopolist earn an economic profit? Yes. How come? How come a monopolist can make an economic profit even in the long run? Because of high barriers to entry. See, in perfect competition, once economic profit is being made, what would happen? More people come in, supply goes to the right, price goes down. But in monopoly, is that going to happen? No. Why? Because of the high barriers to entry. this is a problem. You know, I don't know if you realize it, but you know, over the past 5 years, we've had a tremendous concentration of banks in this country. There are so many fewer banks today than 5 years ago. In fact, a good percentage of all our banking now, about 70% or so of all our banking, is done by five banks. Now, what's the problem with this? I mean, if you're talking about the wealthiest country on earth, and you're talking about that country being dominated by only five banks, what kind of barriers to entry are we talking about here? Those are pretty high barriers to entry, right? And the higher the barriers to entry, and the more now these are not monopolies per se, but we're moving closer and closer. Of course, if these banks collude, they can act as if they were a monopoly. And so, what kind of profit can these institutions make, even in the long run? An economic profit. See, if there was more competition, like you take the banking industry, if you have many more banks, economic profit being made, what would happen? Well, more firms would enter in, supply would shift to the right, price would come down, you see. Price meaning, in this case, maybe interest rates. But with more concentration, the higher barriers to entry, well, economic profits can be made, but more firms are not going to enter in, there's no tendency for supply to shift to the right and for price to come down. I mean, have y'all read that there's been a big increase in certain interest rates over interest rates on credit cards? Now some banks are charging as much as 30% interest on their credit cards. You know, payday companies are charging 300% and 400% a year in interest.
Why is that? Is that not working?
Well, no bank. Well, because of what we're talking about, banks can charge higher prices and get away with it because of the high barriers to entry. See, I'm trying to relate what we're learning here with our banking industry and what's happening today. That's the problem with the concentration of market power. The problem with the concentration of market power is that with the high barriers to entry, firms can charge very high rates even over the long run. And they can make an economic profit even over the long run. And of course, it's the consumer that pays those higher prices. Why do monopolies often earn zero economic profit? What may be a situation where, you've got a monopoly, but that monopoly cannot make an economic profit even in the long run, and that's when we have government regulation. Now, we don't always have government regulation. Like in the banking business, we don't have, in fact, we've gone the opposite way. In the banking industry, we've eliminated many usury laws. You know, do y'all know what usury means? It's an ancient term even used in the Bible. Usury is a term which means unreasonable interest. Usury is the practice of taking advantage of people through unreasonably high interest rates. You know, there's interest rates, and then there's usury interest rates. And we have eliminated many laws that put a cap on usury, where today banks and other institutions can make these very high rates of return legally. See, this is one reason why. I mean, why has production in America declined so much over the recent years? I mean, why is it that we buy so much from China? Why is it we don't produce those things at home like we used to? Well, that's one reason, but what's another reason? If you had money, let's say you've got $1 million, and you could put that money in the productive sector in a company and make 10% return on it on the average. Or you could put your money in the finance, in the banking, in the financial industry, and make maybe 100% return on your money on the average. Now, which would you do? See, when we lift those usury laws, when banks are allowed to charge very high rates of return, that draws resources from other productive elements of their of the economy. And instead of investors saying, oh, I'm going to put my money in a production company, they say, I'm going to put my money in a bank or in an investment company, in a hedge fund, and something like that. You see what I mean? And it's to the point where the majority, a vast majority of our whole country is involved in the financial sector. And very little of it is involved in the productive sector. In fact, if you took out military, if you took out the production of military hardware, our productive capacity in America is very, very small. For that reason. How to compare perfect competition and monopoly, higher prices and less output under monopoly. Resource allocation. You see, we have under conditions of perfect competition, we have a very efficient system. Our resources are used very efficiently, but with a monopoly, that's not necessarily the case. Why does a monopoly charge a higher price and produce a lower quantity than in perfect competition? Now, the tendency here is to say, well, a monopoly has more market power. Because they're the only ones that sell, then they're able to charge a higher price and produce a lower quantity. But that's really not the answer. The answer is because of the different slopes of their demand and marginal revenue curves. And what we've got here, you see, is we've got a comparison between here's the demand, market demand, and this compares what the price would be in conditions of perfect competition and quantity, and what price would be and quantity be under monopoly. The point is that when you have a marginal revenue curve that's underneath your demand curve and more steeply sloped, then, see, in both cases, we're following the M equals MC rule, right? In perfect competition, what quantity we produce to maximize profit? M equals MC. In monopoly, what price did we charge to maximize profit? M equals MC. See, in both cases, we're operating where M equals MC. So what's the difference? Well, the difference is that in monopoly, we've got a marginal revenue curve that's underneath our demand curve and more steeply sloped, and therefore, when we follow the MR equals MC rule of profit maximization, we are going to get a higher price and a lower quantity in a monopoly situation as opposed to perfect competition. See, the answer is not that a monopoly necessarily has more market power. The answer is the different shapes of their curve. Okay. And this explains what the conditions, at least what this is showing us is long-run equilibrium for a perfect competition and monopoly. Okay, now what is rent-seeking? Now, this is a term that is so important in today's economy. Rent-seeking is activities undertaken by individuals or firms to influence public policy in a way that will distribute income to them. See, what is rent-seeking? Well, let's say you own a company, you're producing something, a product. And you've got $1 million to invest. And you say to yourself, which am I going to benefit the most from? putting this $1 million into making a better product, or putting this money into Washington, D.C. to influence legislation that will benefit my company? Now, which way is your $1 million going to give you more bang for the buck? Well, maybe you decide that you could get a much greater return on your investment by putting your money, by hiring lobbyists and putting money into Washington, D.C. And if you do that, that's what's called rent seeking. Rent seeking. It's a term that's very, very common today. Why is it that we've had so many laws passed that favor certain banks? I mean, why, you know, and why is it that, another term that I don't have on these slides is a term called moral hazard. Does anyone know what the term moral hazard means? Like our five big banks. Take Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citibank. When those banks make high-risk investments and then suffer billions of dollars worth of losses, what do they do? What have they done? Yeah, they go to Washington, D.C., and they point a gun to the Congress, and they say, we're too big to fail. If we fail, everything, the whole game is over. The whole economy will fall, so you must give us trillions of dollars so we don't fail, to make up for all these losses we just incurred. Now, a lot of that's possible because these banks, I mean, they've hired literally hundreds of lobbyists. Most of them are previous congressmen and senators and other people in government that, you know, that know people. That's the whole name of the game for a lobbyist, who you know. This is a very lucrative field for any ex-senator or ex-congressman or other government person. And so banks, hire these people, and then they lobby, Washington, D.C., and in their lobbyist efforts, they say, either you do this or. And then we get laws passed favoring banks. So Congress passes laws to give banks, trillions of dollars so they don't fail. Well, those are two terms there, rent seeking and moral hazard. Now, moral hazard is a term that says if certain banks know that they can take high risks, and if those risks, if their investments pan out, they'll make lots of money. But if they don't pan out, well, they still make money because the government bails them out. That's called moral hazard, because how careful will a business be to make investments if they know that even if those investments fail, they'll still get their money? How careful are they going to be if they make, should we make this investment or not? Or how much risk should we take when we make investments? Well, with moral hazard, what difference does it make? You can take as much risk as you want because it's a win-win situation. You take the high risks. If you succeed, you make a ton of money. If you fail, well, that's okay because the government simply gives you the money anyway. So what difference does it make? But what does that breed? What that breeds is risky investments, which leads to a very fragile economy that can very easily fall like a house of cards, which is exactly what's happened. See, when we're talking about a monopoly, I guess what I'm saying here is that in a true sense, like with this chapter, we're talking about a monopoly where you have one firm that controls a market. But when you have a monopoly situation, you've got certain characteristics. Now, those characteristics, a lot of those characteristics, to one degree or another, exist depending upon how much market concentration you have. In other words, if our banking system is pretty much controlled by five banks, then many of these characteristics that we talked about in terms of a monopoly apply. See what I mean? And by the way, you see, in general, it's our big banks that have taken these high risks and have hired lobbyists in Washington, D.C., and it's your smaller banks that have not put money into these collateralized debt obligations and all these, you know, risky ventures. But the smaller banks are therefore more solvent than the big banks. So what has happened? In order to protect their finances, big banks have bought out the little banks. That's why we've had a lot of concentration in the banking industry. Their ledgers look a lot better because the little bank was much better positioned financially than the big bank, so the big bank buys out the little bank, and that makes their financial picture look better. Okay, well, we're almost done here. Oh, I guess we are done, aren't we? So this does end the chapter, and so what are y'all going to do for next time? Read the next chapter. So I'll see y'all next time.